Disc 5. Chapter 16. Lucy looks around at the expensive weight machines and at the windows in the third-floor gym. Her neighbor Kate has all she needs to stay fit, while she enjoys a spectacular view of the Intracoastal Waterway, the Coast Guard station and lighthouse, and the ocean beyond, and much of Lucy's private property. The window in the gym's southern exposure overlooks the back of Lucy's house, and it is more than a little unnerving to realize that Kate can see just about everything that might go on inside Lucy's kitchen, dining area, and living room, and also on the patio, in the pool, and along the seawall. Lucy looks down at the narrow path that runs along the low wall between the two houses, and it is this cedar-chip-covered passageway that she believes he, the Beast, followed to get into the door off the pool, the door Henry left unlocked. Either that, or he arrived by boat. She doesn't believe he did, but has to consider it. The ladder on the seawall is folded up and locked, but if someone was determined to dock at her wall and climb onto her property, certainly it was possible. The locked ladder is deterrent enough for normal people, but not for stalkers, burglars, rapists, or killers. For those people, there are guns. On a table next to the elliptical machine is a cordless phone that plugs into a jack in the wall. Next to the jack is a standard wall socket, and Lucy unzips her fanny pack and removes a transmitter that is disguised as a plug adapter. She plugs it into the wall socket. The small, innocuous piece of spy equipment is off-white, the same bland color as the wall socket, and not something Kate is likely to notice or care about if she does. Should she decide to plug something into the adapter, that is fine. It is functional when connected to AC power. She stands still for an instant, then walks back out of the gym, listening. Kate must still be in the kitchen or somewhere down on the first floor. In the south wing is the master bedroom, an enormous space with a huge canopied bed and a massive flat-screen TV on the wall opposite the bed. The walls overlooking the water are glass. From this perch, Kate has a perfect view of the back of Lucy's house and also into Lucy's upstairs windows. This isn't good, she thinks, as she looks around and notices an empty champagne bottle on the floor next to a bedside table, where there is a dirty champagne flute, a phone, and a romance novel. Her rich, nosy neighbor can see far too much of what might go on at Lucy's house, assuming the shades are open, and usually they're not. Thank God, usually they're not. She thinks about the morning Henry was almost murdered, and tries to remember whether the shades were open or shut. And she spots the telephone jack beneath the bedside table and wonders if she has time to unscrew the plate and replace it. She listens for the elevator, for footsteps on the stairs, and hears not a sound. She gets down on the floor as she pulls a small screwdriver out of the fanny pack. The screws in the plate aren't tight, and there are only two of them, and she has them off in seconds as she listens for Kate. She replaces the generic beige wall plate with one that looks just like it, but is a miniature transmitter that will allow her to monitor any telephone conversations that take place over this dedicated line. A few more seconds, and she plugs the phone cord back in and is on her feet and walking out of the bedroom just as the elevator door opens, and Kate appears holding two crystal champagne flutes filled almost to the top with a pale orange liquid.
"This place is something," Lucy says.
"Your place must be something,"
Kate says, handing her a glass. "You should know," Lucy thinks. "You spy on it enough."
"You'll have to give me a tour sometime," Kate says.
"Anytime, but I travel a lot."
The pungent smell of champagne assaults Lucy's senses. She doesn't drink anymore. She learned the hard way about drinking and no longer touches the stuff. Kate's eyes are brighter, and she is looser than she was not even 15 minutes earlier. She has left the station and is halfway to drunk. While she was downstairs, she probably threw back several flutes of whatever she concocted. And Lucy suspects that while there may be champagne in the glass she holds, Kate probably has vodka in hers. The elixir in Kate's glass is more diluted, and she is quite limber and lubricated.
"I looked out your gym windows," Lucy says, holding the flute while Kate sips. "You could have gotten a good look at anybody who might have come on my property."
"Good is the operative word, hon. The operative word."
She stretches her words, the way people do when they've left the station and are happily on their way to drunk.
I don't make it a habit to be snoopy. Have way too much else for that. Can't even keep up with my own life.
Mind if I use your ladies' room? Lucy asks.
Help your little self, right down there.
She points to the north wing, swaying a little on her widely planted feet. Lucy walks into a bathroom that includes a steam shower, a huge tub, his and her toilets and bidets, and a view. She pours half the drink down the toilet and flushes. She waits a few seconds and walks back out to the landing at the top of the stairs, where Kate stands, swaying slightly, sipping. What's your favorite champagne? Lucy asks, thinking of the empty bottle by the bed.
Is there more than one, hon?
She laughs. Yes, there are quite a few, depending on how much you want to spend.
No kidding. Did I tell you about the time Jeff and I went crazy at the Ritz in Paris? No, of course I didn't tell you. I don't know you really now, do I? But I feel we're becoming friends fast.
She spits as she leans into Lucy and clutches her arm, then starts rubbing it as she spits some more.
No, wait.
She takes another sip, rubbing Lucy's arm, holding on to her.
It was the Hotel de Paris in Monte Carlo, of course. You've been there?
Drove my Enzo there once, Lucy says untruthfully.
Now which one is that? The silver or the black one?
The Enzo is red. It's not here. Lucy almost tells the truth. The Enzo isn't here because she doesn't own an Enzo.
Then you have been to Monte Carlo, to the Hotel de Paris,
Kate says, rubbing Lucy's arm.
Well, Jeff and I were in the casino.
Lucy nods, lifting her flute as if she might have a sip, but she won't.
And I was just knocking around on the 2 euro slot machines and got lucky. Boy, did I get lucky.
She drains her glass and rubs Lucy's arm.
You are very strong, you know. So I said to Jeff, we should celebrate, honey. Back then when I called him honey instead of asshole.
She laughs and glances at her empty crystal glass.
So we tottered back to our suite, the Winston Churchill suite, I still remember. And guess what we ordered?
Lucy is trying to decide whether she should extricate herself now or wait until Kate does something worse than what she is already doing. Her cool, bony fingers are digging into Lucy's arm, and she is pulling Lucy's arm into her thin, pickled body. Dom? Lucy asks.
Oh, honey, not Dom Perignon, mais non. That's soda pop, just a rich man's soda pop. Not that I don't love it, mind you. But we were feeling very naughty and ordered the Cristal Rosé at 560-something euros. Of course, that was Hotel de Paris prices. You've had it?
I don't remember.
Oh, honey, you'd remember, trust me. Once you've had the rosé, there's nothing else. There's only one champagne after that. Then, as if that wasn't bad enough, we moved on from Cristal to the most divine Rouge du Chateau Margaux, she says,
pronouncing her French extremely well for one almost at her destination of drunk.
Would you like the rest of mine?
Lucy holds out her flute as Kate rubs and pulls on her.
Here, I'll trade.
She exchanges her half-full glass for Kate's empty one. Chapter 17. He remembers that time she came down to talk to his boss, meaning whatever she had on her mind was important enough for her to ride the freight elevator, and what a ghastly contraption that was. It was iron and rusty, and the doors shut not from the sides like a normal elevator, but from top to bottom, meeting in the middle like a closed jaw. Of course, there were stairs. Fire codes meant there were always stairs in state buildings, but no one took the stairs to the anatomical division. Certainly not Edgar Allan Poe. When he needed to go up and down between the morgue and where he worked below ground, he felt eaten alive like Jonah when he slammed shut those iron elevator doors with a yank of the long iron lever inside. Its floor was corrugated steel and covered with dust, the dust of human ashes and bones, and usually there was a gurney parked inside that claustrophobic old iron elevator, because who cared what Poe left in there? Well, she did. Unfortunately, she did. So on the particular morning that Pogue has in mind, as he sits in his lawn chair in his Hollywood apartment,
polishing his t-ball bat with a handkerchief. She came off the service elevator, a long white lab coat over her teal-green scrubs. And he'll never forget how quietly she moved across the brown tile floor in the subterranean windowless world where he spent his days, and later some of his nights. She wore rubber-soled shoes, probably because they didn't slip, and were easy on her back when she stood long hours in the autopsy suite cutting up people. Funny how her cutting up people is respectable because she is a doctor, and Pogue isn't anything. He didn't finish high school, although his resume states he did, and that lie, among others, has never been questioned. "We need to stop leaving the gurney in the elevator," she said to Pogue's supervisor, Dave, a strange, slouching man with bruised smudges under his dark eyes, his dyed black hair wild and stiff with cowlicks. "Apparently the body tray is one you're using in the crematorium, which is why the elevator is filled with dust, and that just isn't good form. Probably not healthy, either."
"Yes, ma'am," Dave replied,
and he was working the overhead chains and pulleys, hoisting the naked pink body out of a floor vat of pink formalin, a big, sturdy iron hook in each of her ears, because that was the way they lifted people out of the vats when Edgar Allan Poe worked there.
"But it's not in the elevator."
Dave made a point of looking at the gurney. Scratched and dented and rusting at the joints, it was parked in the middle of the floor, a translucent plastic shroud balled up on top of it. "I'm just reminding you while I think about it. The elevator may not be used by most people in this building, but we still need to keep it clean and inoffensive," said she. Right then, Pogue knew she thought his job was offensive. How else was he supposed to interpret a comment like that? Yet the irony is, without those bodies donated to science, medical students wouldn't have cadavers to dissect. And without a cadaver, where would Kay Scarpetta be? Just where might she be without one of Edgar Allan Pogue's bodies? Although she literally didn't become acquainted with one of his bodies when she was in medical school. That was before his time, and not in Virginia. She went to medical school in Baltimore, not Virginia, and is older than Pogue by about 10 years. She did not speak to him on that occasion, although he can't accuse her of being uppity. She did make a point of saying, "Hello, Edgar Allan," and "Good morning, Edgar Allan," and "Where is Dave, Edgar Allan?" whenever she dropped by the anatomical division with one purpose or another on her mind. But she didn't speak to him on this occasion when she walked fast across the brown floor, her hands in the pockets of her lab coat. And maybe she didn't speak to Pogue because she didn't see him. She didn't look for him either. Had she looked, she would have found him back by his hearth, like Cinderella, sweeping up ashes and bits of bones he had just crushed with his favorite t-ball bat. But what matters is she did not look. No, she did not. He, on the other hand, had the advantage of the dim concrete alcove where the oven was, and had a direct view into the main room where Dave had the pink old woman on hooks, and the motorized pulleys and chains were bumping along smoothly, and she was moving pinkly through the air, her arms and knees hitched up, as if she were still sitting in the vat, and the overhead fluorescent lights flashed on the steel identification tag dangling from her left ear. Pogue watched her progress, and couldn't help but feel a touch of pride, until Scarpetta said, "In the new building, we're not going to do it like this anymore, Dave. We're going to stack them on trays in a cooler, just like we do the other bodies. This is an indignity, something from the Dark Ages. It isn't right."
"Yes, ma'am. A cooler would be fine. We can fit more in the vats, though," Dave said.
And he hit a switch, and the chain came to a dead halt. And the pink old woman swayed as if she were riding a chairlift that suddenly came to a dead halt. "Assuming I can finagle the space. You know how that goes, and they're taking every square foot away from me that they can." "Everything depends on space," Scarpetta said, touching a finger to her chin, looking around, surveying her kingdom. Edgar Allan Poe remembers thinking at the time,
"All right, then. This brown floor with the vats, the oven, and the embalming room are your kingdom at this minute. But when you aren't here, which is 99% of the time, this kingdom is mine. And the people who roll in and are drained and sit in the vats and go up in flames and drift out the chimney are my subjects and friends."
"I was hoping for someone who hasn't been embalmed," Scarpetta said to Dave, as the drawn-up pink old woman swayed from the chain overhead. "Maybe I should cancel the demo."
"Edgar Allan was too quick. Embalmed her and put her in the vat before I had a chance to tell him you needed one this morning," Dave said. "Don't have anyone fresh at the moment."
she unclaimed. Scarpetta looks at the body, pinkly swaying.
Edgar Allan, Dave called out. This one's unclaimed, isn't she?
Edgar lied and said she was, knowing Scarpetta wouldn't use a claimed body, because that wouldn't be in the spirit of what the person wanted when he donated his body to science. But Pogue knew this pink old woman wouldn't have cared, not a bit. All she wanted was to pay God back for a few injustices. That was it. I guess it will be all right, Scarpetta decided. I hate to cancel, so it will work out.
I sure am sorry, Dave said. I know it's not ideal to do a demo autopsy with an embalmed one.
Don't worry about it. Scarpetta patted Dave's arm.
Wouldn't you know, there aren't any cases today. The one day we don't have any, I happen to have the police academy coming through.
Well, send her up.
You betcha. I'm doing you a favor, Dave said with a wink,
and sometimes he flirted with Scarpetta.
Donations are on the lean side.
Just be grateful the general public doesn't see where they'd end up, or you wouldn't get any donations at all, she replied, heading back to the elevator.
We gotta work on those specs for the new building, Dave. Soon.
So Pogue helped Dave unhook their most recent donation, and they placed her on the same dusty gurney Scarpetta had been complaining about minutes earlier. Pogue wheeled the pink old lady across brown tile and onto the rusting service elevator, and they rode up together, and he pushed her out on the first floor, thinking that this was a ride the old woman never planned to take. No, she certainly didn't envision this detour, now did she? And he should know. He talked to her enough, didn't he? Even before she was dead, didn't he? The plastic shroud he had draped over her rustled as he rolled her through the heavy, deodorized air, and wheels clattered along white tile as he guided her toward the open double doors that led into the autopsy suite.
And that, mother dear, is what happened to Mrs. Arnett, Edgar Allan Pogue says, sitting up on the lawn chair, photographs of the blue-haired Mrs. Arnett spread out on the yellow and white webbing between his naked, hairy thighs.
Oh, I know it sounds unfair and dreadful, doesn't it? But it really wasn't. I knew she'd rather have an audience of young policemen than to be carved on by some ungrateful medical student. It's a nice story, isn't it, Mother? A very nice story.
Chapter 18. The bedroom is big enough to hold a single bed and a small table to the left of the headboard and a dresser next to the closet. The furniture is oak, not antique, but not new, and it is nice enough. And taped to the paneled wall around the bed are scenic posters. Jilly Paulson slept at the steps of Siena's Duomo, and woke up beneath the ancient palace of Septimius Severus on Rome's Palatine Hill. She may have dressed and brushed her long hair in the full-length mirror near Florence's Piazza Santa Croce with its statue of Dante. She probably did not know who Dante was. She may not have been able to find Italy on a map. Marino is standing next to a window that overlooks the backyard. He does not have to explain what he is seeing, because it is obvious. The window is no more than 4 feet from the ground, and locks by two thumb latches that, when pressed, allow the window to be slid up easily.
They don't catch, Marino says.
He is wearing white cotton gloves and pushes in the thumb latches, demonstrating how effortlessly one can raise the window. Detective Browning should know about this, Scarpetta says, getting out gloves too, a white cotton pair that is slightly soiled because they permanently reside in a side pocket of her handbag. But there is nothing in any of the reports I've seen that mentions the window lock is broken. Forced?
Nah, Marina replies, sliding the window back down. Just old and worn out. I wonder if she ever opened her window. Hard to believe someone just happened to notice she was home from school and Mom's on a quick errand and, hey, I'll break in and, hey, aren't I lucky the window lock is busted?
More likely someone already knew the window doesn't lock, Scarpetta says.
My guess.
Then someone familiar with this house or able to watch it and gather intelligence.
Huh,
Marino says, walking over to the dresser and opening the top drawer.
We need to know something about the neighbors. The one with the best view of her bedroom's going to be that house.
He nods toward the window with its worn-out lock, indicating the house behind the back fence, the one with a mossy slate roof.
I'll find out if the cops questioned whoever lives back there.
It sounds odd when he refers to police as cops, as if he never was one.
Maybe whoever lives there has noticed someone hanging around the house. I thought you might find this interesting.
Marino reaches inside the drawer and lifts out a man's black leather wallet. It is curved and smooth, the way wallets are when they are habitually kept in a back pocket. He opens it, and inside is the expired Virginia driver's license of Franklin Adam Paulson, born August 14, 1966, in Charleston, South Carolina. There are no credit cards, no cash, nothing else inside the wallet. Dad, Scarpetta says, giving thoughtful attention to the photograph on the license, to the smiling blonde man with a hard jaw and light gray blue eyes the color of winter. He is handsome, but she isn't sure what she thinks of him, assuming one can judge a person by the way he looks on a driver's license. Maybe he is cold, she thinks. He is something, but she doesn't know what, and feels uneasy.
See, I think this is weird, Marino says. This top drawer is like a shrine to him. These T-shirts?
He holds up a thin stack of neatly folded white undershirts.
Size large, men's, maybe dad's, and some are stained and have holes in them. And letters.
He hands her a dozen or so envelopes, several of them greeting cards, it appears, and all with a Charleston return address.
And then there's this.
His thick white cottony fingers pull out a dead long-stem red rose.
You notice the same thing I do?
He asks. It doesn't look very old.
Exactly.
He carefully sets it back inside the drawer.
2 weeks, 3 weeks. You grow roses, he adds, as if that makes her an expert in wilted ones.
I don't know, but it doesn't look months old. It isn't completely dried out. What do you want to do in here, Marino? Dust for prints? It should already have been done. What the hell did they do in here?
Make assumptions, he says. That's what they did. I'll get my case out of the car, take pictures. I can dust for prints. The window frame, this dresser, especially the top drawer. That's about it.
May as well. We can't mess up this crime scene now. Too many people got to it first. She realizes she has just referred to the bedroom as a crime scene, and it is the first time she has called it that.
Then I guess I'll wander out in the yard, he says. 2 weeks, though. Unlikely any of little sweetie's poop would be out there unless it never rained once, and we know it has. So kind of hard to know if there's really a missing dog. Browning said nothing about it.
Scarpetta returns to the kitchen where Mrs. Paulson sits at the table. It does not appear she has moved, but is in the same position, in the same chair, staring off. She doesn't really believe her daughter died of the flu. How could she possibly believe such a thing? Has anybody explained to you why the FBI is interested in Jilly's death? Scarpetta asks, sitting across a small table from her. What have the police said to you?
I don't know. I don't watch that sort of thing on TV,
she mutters, her voice trailing off. What sort of thing?
Police shows, FBI shows, crime shows. Never have watched things like that.
But you know the FBI is involved, Scarpetta says, as her concerns about Mrs. Paulson's mental health gather more darkly. Have you talked to the FBI?
This woman came to see me, I already told you. She said she just had routine questions and was mighty sorry to bother me because I was upset. And that's what she said. I was upset. She sat right there, right where we are, and she asked me things about Jilly and Frank and anybody suspicious I might have noticed. You know, did Jilly talk to strangers? Did she talk to her father? What are the neighbors like? She asked about Frank. A lot about him.
Why do you think that is? What kinds of questions about Frank? Scarpetta probes, envisioning the blonde man with the hard jaw and pale blue eyes. Mrs. Paulson stares at the wall to the left of the stove, as if something is on the white-painted wall that captures her interest. But nothing is there.
I don't know why she asked about him, except that women often do.
She stiffens, and her voice gets brittle.
Oh, boy, do they ever.
And he's where right now? Right this minute, I mean.
Charleston. We may as well have been divorced forever.
She begins to pick at a hangnail, her eyes riveted to the wall, as if something on it seizes her attention. But there is nothing on it. Nothing at all. Were he and Jilly close?
She worships him.
Mrs. Paulson takes a deep, quiet breath, her eyes wide, and her head begins to move, suddenly unsteady on her thin neck.
He could do no wrong. The couch in the living room below the window? It's just a plaid couch. Nothing special about that couch. except it was his spot, where he watched TV, read the paper.
She takes a deep, heavy breath.
After he left, she used to go in there and lie down on it. I could hardly get her off it.
She sighs.
He's not a good father. Isn't that the way it goes? We love what we can't have.
Marino's boots sound from the direction of Jilly's bedroom. This time his big, heavy feet are louder.
We love what doesn't love us back,
Mrs. Paulson says. Scarpetta has made no notes since returning to the kitchen. Her wrist rests on top of the notebook, the ballpoint pen ready, but still. What is the FBI agent's name? She asks.
Oh, dear. Karen, let me see.
She shuts her eyes and touches her trembling fingers to her forehead.
I just don't remember things anymore. Let me see. Weber. Karen Weber.
From the Richmond field office? Marino walks into the kitchen, a black plastic fishing tackle box gripped in one hand, the other holding his baseball cap. He has taken the cap off, finally, perhaps out of respect for Mrs. Paulson, the mother of a young girl who was murdered.
Oh, dear. I guess she was. I have a card somewhere. Where did I put it?
You know anything about Jilly having a red rose? Marino asks from the doorway. There's a red rose in her bedroom.
What?
Mrs. Paulson says. Why don't we show you, Scarpetta says, getting up from the table. She hesitates, hoping Mrs. Paulson can handle what is about to happen. I'd like to explain a few things.
Oh, I guess we can.
She stands and is shaking on her feet.
A red rose?
When did Jilly see her father last? Scarpetta asks, and they head back to the bedroom, Marino leading the way.
Thanksgiving.
Did she go see him? Did he come here? Scarpetta asks in her most non-aggressive voice. And it strikes her that the hallway seems tighter and darker than it was a few minutes ago.
I don't know anything about a rose,
Mrs. Paulson says.
I had to look in her drawers, Marino says. You understand we have to do things like that.
Is this what happens when children die of the flu?
I'm sure the police looked in her drawers already, Marino says. Or maybe you weren't in the room when they were looking around and taking pictures.
He steps aside and lets Mrs. Paulson enter her dead daughter's bedroom. She walks in as far as the dresser to the left of the doorway against the wall. Marino digs in a pocket and pulls out his cotton gloves. He works his huge hands into them and opens a top dresser drawer. He picks up the drooping rose, one of those roses that was furled and never opened, the sort Scarpetta has seen wrapped in transparent plastic and sold in convenience stores, usually at the counter, for a dollar and a half.
I don't know what that is.
Mrs. Paulson stares at the rose, her face turning red, almost the same crimson red as the wilted rose.
I don't have any idea where she got that.
Marino doesn't react visibly. When you came back from the drugstore, Scarpetta says, you didn't see the rose in her bedroom? Possible someone brought it to Jilly because she was sick? What about a boyfriend?
I don't understand,
Mrs. Paulson replies.
Okay, Marino says, placing the rose on top of the dresser in plain view. You walked in here when you came home from the drugstore. Let's go back to that. Let's start with your park in the car. Where did you park when you got home?
In front, right by the sidewalk.
That's where you always park?
She nods yes, her attention drifting to the bed. It is neatly made and covered with a quilt that is the same dusky blue as her estranged husband's eyes. Mrs. Paulson, would you like to sit down? Scarpetta says, giving Marino a quick look.
Let me get you a chair, Marino offers.
He walks out, leaving Mrs. Paulson and Scarpetta alone with a dead red rose and the perfectly smooth bed. I'm Italian, Scarpetta says, looking at the posters on the wall. Not born there, but my grandparents were, in Verona. Have you been to Italy?
Frank's been to Italy.
That's all Mrs. Paulson has to say about the posters. Scarpetta looks at her. I know this is hard, she says gently, but the more you can tell us, the more we can help.
Jilly died of the flu.
No, Mrs. Paulson. She didn't die of the flu. I've looked at her. I've looked at her slides. Your daughter had pneumonia, but she was almost over it. Your daughter has some bruising on the tops of her hands and on her back. Her face is stricken. Do you have any idea how she might have gotten bruises?
No. How could that have happened?
She stares at the bed, her eyes flooded with tears. Did she bump into something? Did she fall down, perhaps fall out of bed?
I can't imagine.
Let's go step by step, Scarpetta says. When you left for the pharmacy, did you lock the front door?
How it was due.
It was locked when you returned home? Marino is taking his time so Scarpetta can begin her approach. Theirs is a dance, and they do it easily and with little premeditation.
I thought so. I used my key. I called out her name to tell her I was home, and she didn't answer, so I thought she's asleep. Oh, good, she needs to sleep,
she says, crying.
I thought she was asleep with Sweetie, so I called out, I hope you don't have Sweetie in the bed with you, Jilly.
Chapter 19. She dropped her keys in their usual spot on the table beneath the coat rack. Sunlight seeping through the transom over the front door lit up the darkly paneled foyer, and white specks of dust moved in the bright light as she took off her coat and hung it on a peg.
I kept calling out, Jilly, honey,
she tells the woman doctor.
I'm home. Is Sweetie with you? Sweetie, where's Sweetie? Now you know if you have Sweetie in the bed loving up on him, and I know you are, he's going to come to expect it. And a little old basset hound with his little short legs can't be getting up and down off that bed by himself.
She walked into the kitchen and set several plastic bags on the table. While she was out, she stopped at the grocery store, figuring she may as well while she was right there at the shopping center on West Carey Street. She took 2 cans of chicken broth out of a bag and set them near the stove. Opening the freezer, she took out a package of chicken thighs and set it in the sink to thaw. The house was quiet. She could hear the wall clock tick-tock in the kitchen. A monotonous, chronic tick-tock she usually did not notice, because she had too much else to notice. In a drawer she found a spoon. In a cabinet she found a glass, and she filled the glass with cold tap water and carried the glass of water, the spoon, and the new bottle of cough syrup down the hallway toward Jilly's room.
When I got to her room,
she hears herself tell the woman doctor,
I said, Jilly, what on earth? Because what I was seeing, it didn't make sense. Jilly, where are your pajamas? Are you that hot? Oh, Lord, where's the thermometer? Don't tell me your fever's gone up again.
Jilly, on top of the bed, face down, naked, her slender back, buttocks, and legs bare, her silky golden hair spilled over the pillow, her arms stretched out straight above her head on the bed, her legs bent like frog legs. Oh, Lord, oh, Lord, oh, Lord. Without warning, her hands began to shake violently. The patchwork quilt and sheet and blanket beneath it were pulled down and hanging off the foot of the mattress, flowing off and pooled on the floor. Sweetie wasn't on the bed, and that got caught in her thoughts. Sweetie wasn't under the covers, because there were no covers, not on the bed. The covers were on the floor, pulled off and on the floor, and Sweetie was caught in her thoughts. And she wasn't startled, hardly even aware, when the bottle of cough syrup, the glass of water, and the spoon hit the floor. She wasn't conscious of letting go of them. And then they were bouncing, splashing, rolling on the floor, water spreading over old wood planks, and she was screaming, and her hands didn't seem to belong to her as they grabbed Jilly's shoulders, her warm shoulders, and shook her and turned her over and shook her and screamed. Chapter 20. Rudy has been gone from the house for a while, and in the kitchen Lucy picks up a copy of a Broward County Sheriff's Office offense report. It doesn't say much. A prowler was reported, and it might be connected to an alleged breaking and entering that happened at the same residence. Next to the report is a large manila envelope, and inside it is the pencil drawing of the eye that was taped to the door. The cop didn't take it. Good job, Rudy. She can do destructive testing on the drawing. And she looks out the window at her neighbor's house and wonders if Kate has begun her return trip from drunk. Believing that going around the bend will somehow make her less drunk, or whatever it is that people believe when they are drunk. The remembered smell of champagne makes Lucy queasy and fills her with dread. She knows all about champagne and rubbing up on strangers who look better the more the alcohol flows. She knows all about it and never wants to make that trip again. And when she is reminded, she cringes and feels a deep, sick remorse. She is grateful that Rudy has gone off somewhere. If he knew what just happened, he would be reminded, and both of them would fall silent. And the silences would only get deeper and more impenetrable, until they finally have a fight and get beyond one more bad memory. When she was drunk, she took what she thought she wanted, only to find out later that she didn't want what she had taken, and was repulsed by it or simply indifferent. This is assuming she could always remember what she did or took, and after a while she rarely remembered. For someone still in her 20s, Lucy has forgotten a lot in life. The last time she forgot, she began to remember when she was standing out on an apartment balcony some 30 stories up, dressed in nothing but a pair of running shorts in the dead of a very cold night in New York, a January night, after a day of partying in Greenwich Village. Just where in Greenwich Village, she still has no idea and doesn't want to know. Why she was out on the balcony, she still isn't sure, but she might have thought she was going to the bathroom and took a wrong turn and opened the wrong door, and had she decided to step over the balcony, assuming it was the tub or who knows what, she would have fallen 30 stories to her death. Her aunt would have gotten the autopsy reports and determined, along with the rest of the forensic profession, that Lucy committed suicide while drunk. No test on earth would have revealed that all Lucy did was stumble out of bed to use the bathroom inside a strange apartment that belonged to a stranger she met somewhere in the village. But that is another story, and one she does not care to dwell on. After those stories, there are no others. She turned on alcohol to pay it back for all the times it turned on her, and now she doesn't drink. Now the smell of drink reminds her of the sour odor of lovers she did not love and would not have touched sober. She looks out at her neighbor's house, then walks out of the kitchen and upstairs to the second floor. At least she can be grateful that Henry was a decision that drinking did not make. At least Lucy can be grateful for that. Inside her office, Lucy turns on a light and snaps open a black briefcase that is no bigger than a regular briefcase, but it is a rugged, hard shell, and inside is a global remote surveillance command center that allows her to access covert remote wireless receivers from anywhere in the world. She checks to make sure the battery is charged and operational, and that the four channel repeaters are repeating, and that the dual tape decks are dually capable of recording. She plugs in the command center to a telephone line, turns on the receiver, and slips on headphones to see if Kate might be talking to anyone from inside the gym or her bedroom, but she isn't, and nothing has been recorded yet. Lucy sits at a table inside her office, looking out at the sun playing on the water and the palm trees playing in the wind, and she listens. Adjusting the sensitivity level, she waits. A few minutes of silence pass, and she slips off the headphones and places them on the table. She gets up and moves the command center to the table where she has set up the crime site imager. The light in the room changes as clouds touch the sun and move on, and then more clouds drift past the sun, and the light dims and brightens inside the office. Lucy pulls on white cotton gloves. She removes the drawing of the eye from its envelope and places it on a large sheet of clean black paper, and she sits down again, puts on the headphones again, and removes a can of ninhydrin from a fingerprint kit. She takes the top off the can and begins to spray the drawing, moistening it, but not too much. Although the spray contains no chlorofluorocarbons and is environment-friendly, she has never found it especially human-friendly. The mist bites her lungs, and she coughs. She takes off the headphones again and gets up again, carrying the chemical-smelling damp paper over to a countertop where a steam iron is plugged in and resting upright on top of a heat-resistant pad. She turns on the iron, and it heats up fast, and she pushes the steam button to test it, and steam hisses out. Placing the drawing of the eye on the heat-resistant pad, she holds the iron no less than 4 inches above the paper and starts the steam. Within seconds, areas of the paper begin to turn purple, and right away she can see purple marks from fingers, marks that she didn't leave, because she knows where she touched the paper when she removed it from the door, and she didn't touch it with her bare hands, and the cop from Brower didn't touch the drawing, because Rudy wouldn't have allowed that. She is careful not to steam the piece of tape, which is non-porous and will not react to ninhydrin, and the heat will melt the adhesive and any possible ridge detail on it. Back at her work table, She seats herself, puts on the headphones and a pair of glasses, and slides the purple-spotted drawing under the lens of the imager scope. She turns it on, then turns on the UV lamp and looks into the eyepiece at a field of bright green, and she smells the unpleasant odor of the cooked chemical in paper. The pencil marks of the eye are thin white lines, and then there is pale ridge detail in a finger mark near the iris of the eye. She adjusts the focus, making the image as sharp as possible, and the ridge detail shows several characteristics and is more than enough to run in the FBI's integrated automated fingerprint identification system. When she ran the latent print she lifted from the bedroom after Henry was almost murdered, the search produced nothing, because the beast has no 10-print card on file. This time, she'll do a latent-to-latent search against more than 2 billion prints in the IAFIS database, and she'll also make sure her office does a manual comparison of the latents from the bedroom and the ones from the drawing. She mounts a digital camera on top of the scope's eyepiece and begins taking photographs. Not 5 minutes later, when she is taking more pictures of another finger mark, this one a smudge with partial ridge detail, the first human sound comes through her headphones, and she turns up the volume and tinkers with the sensitivity level and makes sure one of the recorders is capturing what she is hearing live.
What are you doing?
Kate's drunk voice sounds clearly in Lucy's headphones, and she leans forward in her chair and checks to make sure everything in the command center is up and running fine.
I can't play tennis today,
Kay slurs, and her one-sided conversation is picked up clearly by the transmitter hidden in the adapter Lucy plugged into the wall socket near the window that overlooks the back of Lucy's house. Kate is in the gym, and there is no background noise of the treadmill or elliptical machine. Not that Lucy expects her neighbor to be working out when she is drunk. But Kate isn't too drunk to spy. She is looking out the window at Lucy's house and has nothing better to do than spy. And she probably never has had anything better to do than spy and get drunk.
No, you know, I think I'm getting a cold. You hear it too? You should have heard me earlier. I'm so stopped up, and you should have heard me when I got up.
Lucy stares at the red light on the tape recorder. Her eyes wander to the sheet of paper beneath the lens of the mounted crime scope. The paper is curled from the heat, and the purple smudges on it are large enough to be a man's, maybe. But she knows better than to make assumptions. What matters is there are prints, assuming they are the prints of the beast who taped his beastly drawing to Lucy's door, assuming it is the one who came into her house and tried to kill Henry. Lucy stares at the purple remnants of him, his tracks, his amino acids from his perspiring, oily skin.
Well, I have a movie star next door. How about them apples?
Kate's voice violates the inside of Lucy's head.
Heck no, honey. Not surprised in the least. Let me tell you, I thought so all along. People in and out, all those fancy cars and pretty people in a house that cost, what, 8, 9, 10 million? And a gaudy house, you ask me, just like you expect with gaudy people.
He doesn't care if he leaves Prince. He doesn't care, and Lucy's heart feels hollow, because if he cared, she would be better off. If he cared, it would indicate that he very likely has a criminal record. He has no 10-print card in IAFIS or anywhere. He isn't worried, damn him. He doesn't care because he believes a match isn't going to happen. We'll see about that, Lucy thinks. And she feels his beastly presence as she looks at the purple smudges on the heat-curled drawing of the eye. She feels him watching, and she feels Kate watching. And anger seethes inside Lucy. Deep inside, where her anger crawls and hides and sleeps until something pokes it.
Tina, now, do you believe it? Her last name's flown right out of my head, if she ever told me. Of course she would have. She told me all about it, about her boyfriend and that girl that was attacked and moved back to Hollywood.
Lucy turns up the volume, and the purple on the paper blurs as she stares hard and listens closely to her neighbor talk about Henry. How did she know Henry was attacked? It wasn't in the news. All Lucy told Kate was that there was a stalker. Lucy never said a word about anyone being attacked.
A cute thing. Very cute. Blonde, nice face, and nice figure. Nice and thin. They're all like that, those Hollywood types. Now, that part I'm not sure of. But my feeling is he's the other one's boyfriend, Tina's boyfriend. Why? Well, now that's pretty obvious, hon. If he was the blonde's beau, don't you think he would have left when she did? And she's not been here since the house got broken into and all those police cars and the ambulance showed up.
The ambulance, damn it. Kate saw the ambulance, saw a stretcher being carried out, and she assumes this means Henry was assaulted. I'm not thinking straight, Lucy thinks. I'm not making the connections, she thinks angrily and in growing frustration and panic. What's wrong with you? She says to herself as she listens and stares at the tape recorder inside the briefcase on top of the table near the crime site imager. What the hell is wrong with you? She says to herself. And she thinks of her stupidity in the Ferrari when the Latino was following her.
I wonder the same thing. Why not a word in the news? I looked for it, believe you me.
Kate talks on, her words chewy and distorted, because she is around the bend and more drunk than before.
Yes, you would think so, she says with emphasis,
the slurring more emphatic.
Movie stars and nothing in the news, but that's what I'm getting at. They're here in secret, so the media doesn't know. Well, it does too make sense. It does if you think about it, you silly goose.
Oh, for God's sake, say something important, Lucy mutters to the room. I've got to get a grip, she thinks. Lucy, get a grip. Think, think, think. The long, curly, dark hairs on the bed. Oh, damn it, she thinks. Damn it, I didn't ask her. She pulls off the headphones and places them on the table. She stares around the room as the tape recorder continues to capture her neighbor's one-sided conversation. Shit, she says out loud, realizing she doesn't have Kate's phone number or even know her last name, and she doesn't feel like spending the time and energy to find out, either. Not that Kate will answer the phone if Lucy calls her. Moving to a different desk, Lucy seats herself before a computer and creates a simple document from a template. She fabricates 2 VIP tickets to the premiere of her movie, Jump Out, which will be shown June 6th in Los Angeles, with a private party for the cast and special friends to follow. She prints out the tickets on glossy photographic paper and cuts them to size and tucks them inside an envelope with a note that reads, Dear Kate, loved our chat. Here's a movie trivia quiz. Who's the one with the long, dark, curly hair? Can you figure it out? And she includes a cell phone number. Lucy hurries outside and back to Kate's house, but Kate isn't answering the door or even the intercom. She is around the bend, past drunk, and on her way to unconscious, if she isn't already unconscious. And Lucy places the envelope inside Kate's mailbox. Chapter 21. Somehow Mrs. Paulson is now in the bathroom off the hallway. She doesn't know how she got there. It is an old bathroom that hasn't been renovated since the early 1950s. The floor, a checkerboard of blue and white tiles, and there are a plain white sink, a plain white toilet, and a plain white tub, with a pink and purple floral shower curtain drawn across it. Jilly's toothbrush is in the toothbrush holder on top of the sink, the tube of toothpaste dented, half used up. She doesn't know how she got into the bathroom. She looks at the toothbrush and toothpaste and cries harder. She splashes cold water on her face, but it doesn't do any good. She is sorry she can't hold herself together as she leaves the bathroom and returns to Jilly's bedroom, where the Italian woman doctor from Miami waits for her. That big policeman is thoughtful enough to set a chair in the room, not far from the foot of the bed, and he is sweating. It is cool in the room, and she realizes the window is open, but his face is flushed and glistens with sweat.
Take a load off. The policeman dressed in black says to her with a smile that really doesn't make him look any friendlier.
But she likes the way he looks. She likes him. She doesn't know why. She likes to look at him, and she feels something when she looks at him or gets close to him.
Sit down, Mrs. Paulson, and try to relax, he says.
Did you open the window?
She asks, sitting in the chair and folding her hands in her lap.
I was wondering if it might have been open when you came home from the drugstore, he replies. When you walked in this bedroom, was the window open or shut?
It gets hot in here. The heat's hard to regulate in these old houses.
She is looking up at the policeman and the woman doctor.
It doesn't seem right to be sitting near the bed and looking up at them. She feels nervous and frightened and small as she sits looking up at them.
Julie used to open that window all the time. It might have been open when I got home. I'm trying to remember.
Curtains stir. The white gauzy curtains flutter like ghosts in the sharp cold air.
Yes, she says. I think the window might have been open.
Did you know the lock is broke? The big policeman asks, standing perfectly still, his eyes on her.
She can't remember his name. What was it? Marinara or something.
No,
she answers, and fear is cold around her heart. The woman doctor walks over to the open window and shuts it with her white-gloved hands. She looks out at the backyard.
It's not very pretty this time of year,
Mrs. Paulson says as her heart thuds.
Now in the spring, you should see it.
I can tell, the woman doctor replies. And she has a way about her that Mrs. Paulson finds fascinating, but a little scary. Everything is scary now. I love to garden. Do you?
Oh, yes. Do you think someone came in the window?
Mrs. Paulson asks, noticing black dust on the windowsill and around the window frame. She notices more black dust and what look like tape marks on the inside and outside of the glass.
I lifted some prints, the big policeman says. Don't know why the cops didn't bother, but I got some. We'll see if they're anything. I'm going to need to take yours for exclusionary purposes. I don't guess the cops took your prints?
She shakes her head no as she stares at the window and the black dust everywhere.
Who lives behind your house, Mrs. Paulson? Asks the big policeman in black. That old house behind the fence.
A woman. An elderly woman. I haven't seen her in a while. A long while. Many years. In fact, I can't say she still lives back there. The last time I saw anyone back there was maybe 6 months ago. Yes, 6 months ago or so, because I was picking tomatoes. I have a little vegetable garden back there by the fence, and last summer I had more tomatoes than I could shake a stick at. Someone was on the other side of the fence, just walking back there, doing what, I don't know. My impression was that whoever's back there isn't especially friendly. Well, I doubt it's a woman who used to live there, who lived there 8, 9, 10 years ago. She was very old. I suppose she might be dead by now.
Do you know if the police might have talked to her, assuming she ain't dead? Asks the big policeman.
I thought you're the police.
Not the same kind of police who've been here already, no ma'am. We're not the same as them.
I see,
she says, although she doesn't see at all.
Well, I believe the detective, Detective Brown.
Browning, says a policeman in black.
And she notices that his baseball cap is tucked into the back of his pants. His head is shaved, and she imagines running her hand over his smooth, shaven head.
He did ask me about the neighbors,
she replies.
I said the old woman lived back there, or used to. I'm not sure anybody lives there now. I guess I just said that. I never hear anybody back there, hardly ever, and you can see through the cracks in the fence that the grass is overgrown.
You came home from the drugstore. The woman doctor gets back to that. Then what? Please try to go step by step, Mrs. Paulson.
I carried things into the kitchen, and then went to check on Julie. I thought she was asleep.
After a pause, the lady doctor asks another question. She wants to know why Mrs. Paulson thought her daughter was asleep, what position she was in, and the questions are confusing. Each one hurts like a cramp, like a spasm in a deep place. Why does it matter? What kind of doctor asks questions like this? She is an attractive woman in a powerful way. Not a big woman, but strong-looking in a midnight blue pantsuit and midnight blue blouse that sharpen her handsome features and set off her short blonde hair. Her hands are strong but graceful, and she wears no rings. Mrs. Paulson stares at the doctor's hands and imagines them taking care of Jilly and starts to cry again.
I moved her. I tried to wake her up.
She hears herself saying the same thing again and again.
Why are your pajamas on the floor, Jilly? What is this? Oh, Lord, oh, Lord.
Describe what you saw when you walked in. The doctor asks the same question in a different way. I know this is hard. Marino, would you please get her some tissues and a glass of water?
Where's Sweetie? Oh, Lord, where's Sweetie? Not in bed with you again. She just looked like she was asleep,
Mrs. Paulson hears herself say. On her back? on her front? What was her position on the bed? Please try to remember. I know this is terribly hard, the woman doctor says.
She slept on her side.
She was on her side when you walked into the room, the woman doctor says.
Oh, dear. Sweetie peepeed in the bed. Sweetie, where are you? Are you hiding under the bed, sweetie? You were in the bed again, weren't you? You aren't supposed to do that. I'm going to give you away. Don't you try to hide things from me.
No,
Mrs. Paulson says, crying.
Chili, please wake up, oh, please wake up. This can't be, this can't be.
The lady doctor is squatting by her chair, looking her in the eye. She is holding her hand. The lady doctor is holding her hand and saying something.
No,
Mrs. Paulson sobs uncontrollably.
She didn't have anything on. Oh, dear God, Chili wouldn't be lying there with nothing on. She wouldn't even get dressed without locking her door.
It's all right, the lady doctor is saying, and her eyes and touch are kind. There is no fear in her eyes. Take deep breaths. Come on. Breathe deeply. There. That's good. Slow, deep breaths.
Oh, Lord, am I having a heart attack?
Mrs. Paulson blurts out in terror.
They took my little girl. She's gone. Oh, where's my little girl?
The big cop in black is back in the doorway, holding a handful of tissues and a glass of water.
Who's they? He asks.
Oh, no. She didn't die of the flu, did she? Oh, no. Oh, no. My baby girl, she didn't die of the flu. They took her from me.
Who's they? He asks. You think more than one person had something to do with this?
He steps into the room, and the lady doctor takes the water from him. She helps Mrs. Paulson sip it slowly. That's good. Drink slowly. Slow breaths. Try to calm down. Do you have someone who can come stay with you? I don't want you staying alone right now.
Who's they?
Her voice rises as she repeats the policeman's question.
Who's they?
She tries to get up from the chair, but her legs won't work. They don't seem to belong to her anymore.
I'll tell you who they are.
Grief turns to rage, such a terrible rage that she is afraid of it.
Those people he invited over here, them. You ask Frank who they are. He knows.
End of Disc 5.